We have Hubert Dillon on the biological approach, and I think I see one person over there who will be very supportive, Charles. And I'm personally going to be very fascinated with this because I really don't know what the biological approach to ethics is, and I think it's going to be of great interest to all of us. I think we have to wait a moment while the electronics are put in working order. Hugh has not a handout pre-talk, but there will be a summary of what he said available for issue after he has talked. Will they be on the back, Hugh?
Yeah, I've got them.
Sorry, Tom Fisher has them, so if you can get them from him. Yeah. Are we all fixed up?
Yeah, yes.
Okay, thank you. Over to you, Hugh.
All righty. Well, thank you very much, Frank. Ladies and gentlemen, in the next 20 minutes, I will try to shift your worldview. The only person who ever said that to me succeeded. But it was Amartya Sen, and he was on Radio 4 talking about the causes of farm famine, perhaps I can't hope to be so successful this morning, but I'll be disappointed if I don't manage to cause, if not apoplexy, then at least mild philosophical irritation. Why should we be good? Or why should we be good? Well, by the way, I hope you don't mind if I put up greetings from David White, who would love to be here today, but hasn't been able to manage, and from the rest of the gang back in Stockholm. Why should we be good? Or why should we be good? Well, what do we mean when we say that something or some experience or some behaviour is good? I believe what we mean is that we approve of it. The word good is an expostulation, an adjective we use to describe a thing or a deed or an experience which arises in us, a feeling we like. I had a good rest. I did some good work. Things which actually stand in contradiction can both be described as good. So thinking about feelings provides an appropriate starting point in moral theorizing. This is not a new idea. In the opening sentence of the Theory of Moral Sentiments, Adam Smith notes that the happiness of others is necessary to even the most selfish of us, though we derive nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing it. And David Hume famously finds that reason is only the slave of the passions. Do you remember Dan, the druggist on the corner? He was never mean or ornery. He was swell. He killed his mother-in-law and ground her up real well and sprinkled just a bit over. What a reprobate. But why do we say so? Did Dan act basely because he failed to increase the sum of human happiness, or because he didn't act by a maxim he was prepared to universalize, or because he disobeyed God's commandments, or because he'd be a less virtuous person as a result of what he'd done? No. Dan's act is wicked because we all feel it to be wicked. And so should he have done, in our strong opinion. Dan's is what William Gass calls a clear case, the sort of case in which we build our moral theories, not the sort of case to be arbitrated by a moral theory. Our moral feelings are primary. I would argue that our feelings represent the sum total of morality, but they certainly play a central role. We have impulses to seek happiness, including the happiness of others, impulses to be generous, impulses to empathize, impulses to be fair, impulses to explore the world. These impulses either are our feelings or they are accompanied by our feelings. My claim is that this is our nature, our acculturated biology. It is a fact about the world. But it is right, shouldn't we expect to find evidence of moral behavior or moral sensibility in other species? Why should Homo sapiens, having come through a common evolutionary process, expect to be unique in such an important character? I think we can find such evidence. Let's start with altruism. In evolutionary biology, an organism is said to behave altruistically when its behavior benefits other organisms at a cost to itself.
The vampire bat
behaves altruistically. The bat is a precarious lifestyle, flying out at night to suck food from reluctant larger hosts. Often that party is unsuccessful, potentially a calamitous event, since the bat needs energy from food to fuel its next sortie. What happens then is, a successful neighbour regurgitates some of its own booty to feed the unlucky individual. G.S. Wilkinson has noted that this is not an automatic response. That would encourage laziness and incompetence. And it doesn't happen. Instead, bats are observed sometimes to help out and sometimes not. What makes the difference is whether the hungry bat has helped others in the past. Doesn't that imply the bats would have to know the other individuals in their colony and store some memory of the food regurgitating behavior of each? Apparently so. Wouldn't that require brain power beyond that of the ordinary bat? Yes, it would. Could that be why the vampire has an unusual for a bat bump on its forehead, perhaps to accommodate extra brain material? Who knows? The point is, the tendency to behave with a qualified altruism has evolved in software and or hardware to fit the bat to exploit a difficult environmental niche. Thomas Nagel may ask, what does it feel like to be a bat in these circumstances? I say, it doesn't matter how the bat feels, it's what it does that counts. As might be expected, more adaptable animals exhibit more complex traits. I was lucky enough to get to attend Tucson 96, the second international conference on consciousness studies in the University of Arizona. It was an enormous multidisciplinary conference with some very big names among the speakers. David Chalmers was there explaining the heart problem. Dan Dennett and Patricia Churchman were there explaining the heart problem away. Roger Penrose was making the heart problem harder. As can be imagined, of a large interdisciplinary conference, things quickly got technical, so the most memorable session was one in which everyone engaged and everyone understood what was being said. The session was taken by three women who worked with animals. First up was Dr. Irene Pepperberg. For the past 26 years, Dr. Pepperberg has been studying the cognitive and communicative abilities of African grey parrots. She described how her oldest bird, Alex, can identify about 50 different objects using English labels. He can also identify labels 7 colors, 5 shapes, and quantities up to and including 6. He has functional use of phrases like, I want X, and I want to go Y, where X and Y respectively are object or location labels. He combines these labels to identify, refuse, request, and categorize more than 100 different items. He has concepts of bigger and smaller, of category, of sameness and difference, of absence of information, and of number. Dr. Pepperberg tests Alex not only through direct questions about these concepts, for example, what color bigger for 2 differently sized colored blocks, but also by using questions that involve complex structures, such as what object is green and 3 colored. He answers all these questions with about 80% accuracy. Her team thinks the reason he doesn't achieve 100% accuracy is boredom. He seems to get tired of repeatedly answering questions about colors and shapes and materials. For example, he sometimes will state every color by the correct one, behavior that suggests he's carefully avoiding the right answer. Statistically, he couldn't do that by chance. Furthermore, Alice demonstrates a certain level of intentionality involving the quest. If he says that he was great, and you give him bananas or pepper bear, you are going to end up wearing a banana. Next up was Professor Diana Rice to speak of her work with bottlenose dolphins. Rice claims dolphins clearly engage in exploratory behavior. For example, they blow bubble rings just as humans blow smoke rings from cigarettes, and then play with the rings as they rise to the surface. She has even seen them drop various items, such as bits of fish or seaweed, into the center of a bubble ring and watch how the turbulence buffets them. It looks like intelligent, goal-directed behavior, she says. I felt like I was watching a bunch of scientists test contingencies. Rice claims to have demonstrated mirror self-recognition on the part of dolphins and exceedingly rare capacity in the animal kingdom. Previously, only humans and great apes have shown convincing evidence of it. At Tucson, Rice recounted how, if the animals misbehave in the course of their training, she would give them a timeout. This involves hurrying up from the edge of the pool and walking back 20 feet and looking at the dolphin, but not interacting with it. One day when feeding a dolphin, Rice accidentally let a tail with fins, a disliked food, slip through. In response, the dolphin swam to the other side of the pool and rose vertically up the water to look at Rice for a minute or two. Rice felt she was being given a timeout. She decided to test the dolphin and a few days later let an uncut fish tail slip through on purpose. The dolphin did the same thing, giving her another timeout. Rice repeated the experiment 3 additional times, each with the same result. Third up was Sue Savage Rumbo. Savage Rumbo reared a pair of bonobos and pygmy chimpanzees in the company of humans who spoke English to them and pointed to symbols on a board. While the bonobos, Kanzi and Pambamisha, never received any explicit training in language, they picked it up anyway. These conditions are all that is needed for apes to acquire understanding of language at least equal to a 3-year-old child, says Savage Rumbo. For example, the bonobos can respond correctly, even on first hearing, to new sentences such as, can you find the pine needles in the refrigerator? Kenzie and Pambanisha understand more complex concepts. For example, Savage Rumbo describes how Pambanisha watched as a human secretly substituted a bug for some sweets in a box. When a second human tried to open the box, the first human asked the bonobo, what is she looking for? Pambanisha replied that the human was looking for the sweets. To answer a question as sophisticated as this, Pambanisha needs a concept of what thinking is and that other people's thinking is different from her own, says Savage Rumbo. Even more strikingly, Pambanisha added that the first person was being bad. To play such a trick, the same comment that the researcher's 4-year-old daughter made. I hope I've conveyed some sense that intelligence, a sense of self, and moral feelings may not be the exclusive province of Homo sapiens. The parrot, the dolphin, and the bonobo are all reported by distinguished researchers to have expressed disapproval when the behavior of another party fell short of an expected standard. Note how widely separated are the evolutionary chains of these species. Simon Conway Morris is an evangelist for evolutionary convergence. Evolution is not a blind random process, he argues. It moves to fill available environmental niches, developing organisms and biological instruments to exploit the prevailing conditions. The same conditions have produced recognizably the same capabilities in highly divergent species many times over. Sometimes entirely separate species are superficially very similar, though radically different under the hood, as in the marsupial lion of prehistoric Australia, which came with a full set of lion characters, including retracting claws. Conway Morris does not regard the step to human levels of rationality as one that must necessarily be specially difficult. It may have been taken more than once in evolutionary history, we having dispatched any consequent competition. And he claims that our launching pad, marginally subhuman intelligence, has evolved separately at least 3 times in primates, dolphins, and birds. He references the New Caledonian crow as the cleverest of the birds. The evolutionary success of some animal species is attributable to social cooperation, and that cooperation requires respect for standards of behavior. It also requires pressure from without in the shape of a desire to see fair play, and motivation from within, a desire to comply with expectations, to keep individual behaviors in social harmony. And crucially, it depends on trust in the prospects of good behavior being forthcoming in other individuals. That these instruments are not unique to the human species, having evolved independently more than once, may tell us something significant by the kind of universe we live in. This is not to say that we are the prisoners of biological drives, some of them moral. I believe in consciousness, in self-examination, and in our capacity and duty to choose the right thing. The trouble with feelings is they are conflicted. We have to decide when to go with one and curb another. And we need a rationale for such decisions, a fixed moral direction, a star to travel by. In this age of relativity, fixed directions are hard to come by. But I know of one. Raymond Flood and Michael Lockwood edited a highly readable little book called The Nature of Time, in which P.W. Atkins had a nice piece about the second law of thermodynamics. Over time, says the second law, according to Atkins, things tend to get worse, to disperse, to get in a mess. By things is meant particles of matter, energy, and coherence. This is the character of universal systems. They run down. Ultimately, everything ends in cold chaos. Well, here is a direction. The direction in which things change. The drift to maximum entropy. But that's not what happens right here. The flows of energy which characterize the universe's progress and shambles provide opportunities for local reversal of the process. Anyone lucky enough to be situated between a hot star and cold deep space knows at first hand how in these circumstances the direction of change is reversed. Order springs from chaos. That has been our own situation for thousands of millions of years, and hopefully for as many to come. Our direction, the one by which we can set our moral compass, is the direction of increasing order, increasing assemblage of structured information, increasing understanding, increasing complexity. How does this happen? Look around. It's just the astonishing nature of the world we live in. The physicist Richard Feynman describes how, as a PhD student, he was once awakened from a deep sleep in the middle of the night by a call from his supervisor, John Wheeler. Wheeler was desperate to share an amazing new insight. He had realized why all electrons are identical. Because there's only one electron, he insisted, down the phone. Is that amazing or what? Alas, actually, we didn't survive a cold light day, but it's the premise of the question which is really amazing. Electrons are of a class of fundamental physical particles which are, in principle, indistinguishable. If they were distinguishable, the laws of physics would be markedly different. Electrons are highly mysterious entities, sometimes behaving like bullets, sometimes like waves. They can, and often do, pop in and out of existence in a puff of energy. In the right conditions, they link with those other fundamental particles, the proton and the neutron, to form atoms of hydrogen, helium, lithium, and all the elements of the periodic table. And the elements, as everybody knows, readily jump into bed with each other to form up to 30 million chemical compounds. In time, admixtures of the more complex compounds in the right proportions burst into life. This is change in the direction of increasing order. It happens because of the remarkable, unfathomable nature of the stuff of which everything, including us, is made. This is no heap of inert grains of sand waiting on an imaginative designer to make a cathedral of it. When there's energy about, stuff pulsates, halts and grows in ever-increasing complexities until it develops imagination. The new life forms diversify and compete for the occupation of environmental niches. Some niches are so precarious as to be available only to highly complex organisms. The force responds. Some niches can't be held by individual organisms at all, but only by groups acting cooperatively. The force responds again. When my grandparents, of fond memory, were born, all this would have been called magic. The process generates plants, grazing animals, prey and predators, signalling, language, enumeration, patience, curiosity and exploration, happiness, social rules and moral feelings, and finally, through our own species, levels of consciousness sufficient to support love, introspection, wonder, imagination, aesthetic transport, rationality, and the building of complex instruments and artifacts beyond the reach of biological evolution working on its own. It may be said then that our universe is on the march in the direction of diminishing entropy. We are its current front rank. Those things are good which are conducive to the continuing expansion of knowledge, creativity, and control. Those things are bad which impede it. We have a thrilling opportunity to take this work forward to new heights of knowledge and structure, and we have our own special human capacity to apply knowledge imaginatively and creatively. All our faculties are honed for the task. We can write symphonies, paint pictures, frame and test hypotheses about how the world works, cook meals, plant flowers, build garden sheds and pyramids, record our knowledge and transmit it to new generations. In a sense, it's our function. If we're not up to the job, we'll be gone and replaced. It's a plausible deduction from the facts I've given that, like the central supervising characters in Arthur C. Clarke's Childhood's End, we're here to take control, to pilot the ship prudently through the next stage of its passage, mindful of the fact that the journey is long compared to our lifespan or even the lifespan of our species. We can only do it together, and our collective effort requires a great supporting infrastructure, a spectrum of individual roles wide enough to accommodate everybody. It also requires the set of socially cohesive moral sensibilities with which we are all endowed. We need to harness our endowment to the project. He who turns his back on such a challenge should feel shame for a dereliction of duty. He who takes the tide at its flood earns a universal accolade. Isn't that why we should be good?
Well, from molecules to Boros.
You're good, isn't it?
Sorry?
Yes, well put.
Questions?
Yes.
Yes. Of course, we are totally determined by our genes. And this is the biological fact of life. In fact, a forensic scientist in America has now determined three of the genes that contribute to violence and one or two that contribute to stopping the violence. So every attitude that we have is genetic. And so furthermore, what you are born with also is reinforced by your parents. Because if they gave you the genes, they must have them. So that if 50% of your genes you were born with, and then another 30% were contributed by your parents in teaching you. So that it is about 80 or 90% of who you are now is in your genes.
Okay. Do you agree along with that? Sorry, I think time is limited, so...
I don't agree with that. I think that we do have a personal choice, that not everything is determined. And if we all thought that everything was determined, we wouldn't come. We wouldn't come to a deal like this.
Could I just quickly reply to that?
Quickly.
What I've said, none of you like. Therefore, it is never published. And it cannot be published, because any newspaper that published it would lose readers. If the BBC published it, they'd lose listeners. If politicians published it, they would lose voters. So the truth cannot be perpetrated.
Okay, thank you. Eileen.
Yes, okay. I was just going to say, just because no one publishes something doesn't follow from that that it's true.
I didn't say that.
Bill, were you...
No.
Oh, sorry, I thought you had a question.
Yes,
Another question? Yes?
I think it's probably a good argument that genes provide, that biology provides predispositions, but it doesn't determine actions. It probably isn't easy to do imagination. I've occasionally wanted to learn it, but I haven't done so, because I hope I've got some kind of moral sensibility that I've chosen to acquire rather than the predisposition. I'm speaking of someone who's recently read John Gray's work, Straw Dogs and Black Mass and Heresies, and as a would-be liberal, I find myself disturbingly drawn towards it in many ways. Now, he had this argument that we are fundamentally animals, and that it's a form of moral arrogance to consider ourselves as separate, which I think is a very attractive element of your argument. I think what he would say is that we behave both as morally and as immorally as the rest of the animal kingdom does, and precisely more pointedly that it is our responsibility to encourage in ourselves those parts of ourselves that would move us apart from, rather than back to the animals that entropically, left to our instincts, we probably would in fact become.
Yeah. I think it's useful to distinguish between the utility of the biological influence on the behaviour of large groups of people, on the one hand, and our personal responsibility to make the right moral choices as individuals, on the other hand. I think in the mass, you can predict that if you oppress people, some people will react violently to that situation. But that's not a reason for not condemning somebody who goes out to kill innocent people for the purpose of drawing attention to injustice which is happening back home.
My problem is with prescriptivism. You gave us one kind of answer of why we should be good. But a lot of morals or moral language is prescriptive language. And it was that element of why we should be good that I was slightly missing from your biological account.
I think what I'm arguing is that we are in a project with the rest of creation. We don't have any option about being in the project. Our only option is whether to participate enthusiastically or not. And since it's such an exciting project, there can only be one answer.
Can I ask, does it matter morally whether the project, as you find it, succeeds or not? That is a point that comes to mind. You know, it's wonderful what you said, and we all would go along with it. But thinking about it, does it really matter? What makes it matter?
Well, if it doesn't matter, how can anything else matter? If anything matters, it is the central theme of the project that we find ourselves involved in.
Peter?
As far as I've got the picture clear, you're essentially trying to tell us that our moral life is continuous with the animal community, and that's the enlightening way to see it. I'm trying to think that that's quite a good story for sort of low-level human morality, if you think of people sort of moving around in a bus queue or a shop or these kind of things. As the level of requirement goes up and it gets more and more difficult, it seems to me you get further and further away. And if you're looking at complex dilemmas of medical ethics, where our biology comes from or which genes are operating seems to break down. It certainly seems to break down in this room where we're negotiating between, you know, whether Aristotle or Kant or someone has got the best moral theory. We seem to be so far away from genetics, it doesn't seem to me to throw any light on it at all.
I think we do need some way of reconciling the high regard with which we hold Julius Caesar on the one hand, and Albert Schweitzer on the other hand, and that's what I'm trying to provide. At a lower level, we've got to work out whether what behaviour from the choices that are available to us at a particular place and time are which of these choices is best going to advance the overall aim of the project, which is the progress towards a greater understanding of the world and the control over our environment that is going to bring.
Why should that be our project?
Because it's at the highest possible level. That is what is happening in the universe. If we are prepared to join it, then it gives meaning to our lives. If we try to swim against it, we are doomed, A, to failure, and B, to meaninglessness.
Mm. Which, thank you very much, Hugh, for a dynamic presentation. Oh, and Tom here has summaries, bullet points, I take it, of what you had to say.